WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On this episode, we'll be strolling down one of our memory lanes, a byway lined with bones and running with blood. Is my prose too purple for this season of Sun and Sea? Then I'll just say that we're devoting this week to true crime. It's all the rage.
This is a Global CalLink prepaid call from
Adnan Sayed.
No, we won't be talking about Serial. I mean, what else is left to say? It's the podcast that more than any other introduced the nation to the idea of podcasts. A gripping, thoughtful offshoot of This American Life, Serial spent 12 half hours exploring one 16-year-old murder, and it ended in December 2014, leaving the nation stoked for more true crime on the radio. Until Serial, radio was maybe the last narrative platform not conquered by true crime. Certainly, it had long dominated TV and movies and long been a best-selling book genre. In fact, when we picture true crime, that's what we see.
You know, the glossy paperbacks full of crime, punishment, and ordinary people behaving badly that decorate the supermarket checkout aisle. But don't let those foil covers fool you, says former Salon writer Laura Miller. Much true crime, she says, rises above mere pulp. And she should know. She's been a true crime aficionado since childhood. Helter Skelter, the book about the Manson killings, was Miller's entree into the genre.
I first probably read Helter Skelter when I was babysitting, which is a very important vector of introduction to true crime for young women, is when you're babysitting and you look for the dirty books and the sugary snacks. But I probably the one that really just electrified me the most was on television. It was a docudrama with Robert Stack about the Black Dahlia killer. At the very end, he looks out at the audience from the television screen and he says, "You're out there. I know you're still out there," to the killer. And it just, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And that was when I was really hooked. It was the way that this outrageous thing that they were showing you on the screen, but they wouldn't show you all of it because it was too gruesome, was connected to the real world that I inhabited. You know, like maybe the Black Dahlia killer was not just out there, but right outside my window.
And yet there's kind of a stigma attached to true crime. And I guess it's not hard to figure out why, but why don't you tell me why?
Most true crime really is pretty trashy. I mean, it's voyeuristic, it's lurid. You know, that's an earned reputation. It's just that not all of the genre has those characteristics, and there are things that the genre can do that really no other genre can. And given how much of a factor crime is in all of the entertainment that we consume, Law and Order, or you're reading detective fiction, which is pretty much the most popular form of genre fiction there is, you're just consuming a huge number of narratives that are not necessarily representative of what crime and justice and detection are like in real life.
I have read Helter Skelter about the Manson killings. I read The Onion Field and I read Fatal Vision. None of those are prominent in my bookcases at this point. And yet In Cold Blood sits there right prominently.
Capote is a great stylist, so it's a pretty high class piece of work. Also, there's not a whole lot of mystery about the killing of the Clutter family, which is what Capote was writing about, but there is a mystery about why it came to be committed, because the people who committed it, they were monstrous without being entirely monsters. It's a book full of unanswered questions. I mean, that to me is what defines a great true crime book, is its willingness to accept the unanswerable about humanity and the impossibility of achieving justice.
If there's a definition of serious journalism, it's that the story matters. It has some significance to the reader beyond the lurid particulars. Is that the litmus test for differentiating good true crime from pulp?
I think that the right writer can make a particular crime matter when the wrong writer cannot. And a great example is Robert Kolker's book, Lost Girls, which is about some bodies of young women that had been found on Long Island, and no one is really sure if it's a serial killer situation. It's pretty ambiguous. Most of his book is the story of these young women and their lives and how they came to be in the situation where they were killed. Now, there's a New York Post way of telling that story, which is that they were all call girls who were working off of mostly Craigslist, and there's this scary monster, boogeyman-like figure out there. Or there's the question of how someone becomes a victim told in a way that brings in the whole social context. So that it becomes something more than just a freakish, scary occurrence that you kind of goggle at. And it instead looks at it as an inevitable symptom of some aspect of our society. The stories together move our frame of mind to a fuller grasp of reality.
In addition to your other duties for Salon, you write a book column every week.
Right.
You believe that we are in a golden age of true crime. How so?
Well, some of the great books that have come out just in the past couple of years have been Raymond Bonner's Anatomy of Injustice, which is the story of a wrongful murder conviction. There is a book that's just published by a group of people at the Columbia Law School called The Wrong Carlos, which is about another wrongful conviction that resulted in an execution in Texas. There's Errol Morris's A Wilderness of Error, which is a reconsideration of the Jeffrey McDonald conviction for the murder of his family.
Possibly one of the most written about true crimes.
Yeah.
Outside of the Kennedy assassination.
It was written about by Joe McGinnis, and then Joe McGinnis was written about by Janet Malcolm, and now the whole kit and caboodle has been written about by Errol Morris.
Now, we've discussed some classics.
Yeah.
What is the ultimate desert island classic in this genre?
Oh, God, what a question. You're supposed to say In Cold Blood, which is a really magnificent piece of work, but I think I would pick A Wilderness of Error. What it really brought home to me is the way that we think that we can look at the evidence and get a definite answer, but the more you look at it, the more you see, and the more you know, the less certain you become. And that, to me, is really the best message that the best true crime delivers.
Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Miller is now a columnist for Slate. Her piece on this subject is titled Sleazy, Bloody, and Surprisingly Smart in Defense of True Crime.
Coming up, the tabloidification of justice.
I felt like when they said that defense rested its case, I couldn't believe it. I was like, no way. And I think that the circus of the media was ridiculous. About 10 billion cameras going off and everybody's taking billions of pictures, and which I think rots. I just think it rots.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The same crime looks and sounds very different when conveyed in a newspaper headline or a courtroom summation or on a movie screen. Last summer, we aired an interview about a landmark moment for true crime drama, a case study in the hazards of cameras in the courtroom. The year was 1991. The defendant was a young woman named Pamela Smart, and the murder victim was her husband, Gregory Smart. The case oozed with tabloid succulence. She was 22, pretty, a media coordinator for several New Hampshire high schools, charged with conspiracy to commit murder with her lover and trigger man, the sweet-faced 15-year-old Billy Flynn. The media seized upon the juicy optics and took it to the court of public opinion.
According to police, Pamela Smart convinced her teenage lover to murder her husband.
Now, Pamela Smart offering to pay each teenager $1,000 for the murder of her husband.
Smart's trial was the first to be covered on TV gavel to gavel. It also rather quickly inspired a TV movie with Helen Hunt playing Smart, and later a novel by Joyce Maynard, and after that, a feature film inspired by the novel starring Nicole Kidman.
You're not anybody in America unless you're on TV. On TV is where we learn about who we really are. Because what's the point of doing anything worthwhile if nobody's watching? And if people are watching, it makes you a better person.
A documentary focusing on the coverage of the case, called Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart, was aired on HBO in 2014. Director Jeremiah Zager said he wanted the film to look at the lookers, that is, the coverage and the news consumers, including the lawyers, the judge, and the jury. He says the Pamela Smart case began just as the litigation-obsessed media machine we know today was ramping up.
It was the beginning of CNN. It was the beginning of Court TV. It was the beginning of all these cable news networks who needed to fill a 24-hour news cycle. WMUR, the local TV station, decided to cancel all the shows that were broadcast during the trial and broadcast only the trial. People were hungry for whatever they could hear about the Pamela Smart case.
So a local TV station became the Pamela Smart channel, and like the OJ trial that happened later, it created its own media stars. So tell me about WMUR reporter Bill Spencer. He actually plays himself in the Helen Hunt film.
Bill Spencer is a larger-than-life character. He considers himself a muckraker of sorts, and he's the guy that broke the story, ultimately. He's the guy that got the first interview with Pam, and then he ran with it. And he was also being pushed really hard to keep going after this story.
Going after the story or going after her? I mean, was he part of the crowd that convicted her in advance of the verdict?
He was, and he felt like he had uncovered the facts of the case before the police. And as a result, he broadcast 2 days before the jurors were even picked a documentary that over and over again stated how guilty Pamela Smart was.
So let's talk about the venue for this trial and whether or not it was possible for Pamela Smart to get a fair trial.
I think in this case, the media became a poison, and it poisoned every witness and it poisoned every moment of that trial.
And part of your evidence for that comes from something extraordinary. The actual tapes that a juror made every night in her bathtub after each day's trial about what she herself was thinking. First of all, this juror said that they didn't give Pamela Smart a defense.
I felt like when they said that defense rested its case, I couldn't believe it. I was like, no way. That's not fair, because I don't believe she deserves that. And I think that the circus of the media was ridiculous. About 10 billion cameras going off, and everybody's taking billions of pictures, and which I think rots. I just think it rots.
I think in that tape, there's a lot of regret that you can hear in her voice. Regret over the sentence Pamela Smart has received, and regret over having delivered that guilty verdict. And I think what you're hearing there is her recounting what led up to that sentence and her justifying giving it to her. You know, she didn't get a defense. It's not my fault.
She said that she wouldn't have convicted Pamela Smart if she'd known that the sentence was going to be life in prison without parole.
I really believe that I would have hung that jury, because I was damn close to doing it anyway, had I known what this sentence was going to be. I'm not responsible for what I was to consider as evidence. I had no control over evidence that was given. I believe there's so much that no one knows, and we'll probably never know.
But she also said that there was plenty of reasonable doubt. So why did she convict?
The truth is that 12 Angry Men scenario, where Henry Fonda sits at the end of the table and convinces the 11 other jurors that there's reasonable doubt, is a fantasy. In reality, when three jurors or less feel there's reasonable doubt, they're swayed 90% of the time to the majority's opinion, like a schoolyard, like peer pressure. When there's four, it decreases to about 50%. And ultimately, I think she was swayed. She looked at the evidence with those jurors and, you know, they wanted to go home.
So what do you believe at the end of this process? That it would be better if there were no cameras in the courtroom?
Well, no, not necessarily, because I think when you look at, you know, the lack of transparency in military trials, it's troubling. And there is a need for transparency in the trial process. And the problem is when the trial becomes sensationalized, commerce and justice begin to mix. And I think that's really problematic.
So what's the solution?
I don't have solutions. I don't have clear answers. And I think the film is attempting to bring up questions so that ideally, you know, people involved in the justice system can make structures to make things more fair. Now, one of the attorneys we talked to, J. Albert Johnson, said the trial should have been stayed. And it should have been stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed until it was no longer a story.
Wait until the controversy blew over? That could take decades if you have people like Bill Spencer on the case.
Right. And that's the problem. And there's a desire for retribution in the public. And therefore, it's very possible that a person who didn't commit the crime they're convicted of is convicted of that crime. Until there's not a thirst for blood, it's very difficult in a sensationalized environment to find where the truth lies.
Where do you think the trial went most wrong for Pamela Smart?
It went wrong every step of the way. The young men who took plea bargain deals, who actually committed this murder, were housed together and therefore able to get their stories straight. The young woman who was the key witness was under contract for $100,000 for a movie deal. The media was sensationalizing every moment and every soundbite and every image that was recorded. The judge also got caught up in it. At the end of the trial, he said he hoped that Clint Eastwood would play him in the movie. And that was sort of a joke, but it was emblematic of an environment that had been created. For that reason, she got a very unfair trial.
Do you think she did it?
I think the only people who know what happened is Pamela Smart and Bill Flynn. He says she told him to kill her husband. She says she never told him that. It's impossible to prove it either way. What is clear is that this woman got an incredibly unfair trial. And what is clear is that her sentence is incredibly disproportionate, that she'll spend the rest of her life in prison without the possibility of parole, which, by the way, Charles Manson has the possibility of parole. And these young men are about to get out. You know, they're on work release as we speak. And what is clear also is that there is a problem when we cease to question the systems of our government, our justice system, our political system, our media system. If anything, I hope that this film allows the audience to question more and to feel comfortable questioning, that what makes our system strong are the questions that we ask.
And what's the question we should be asking of the media?
How are these images being shot? How are these images being edited? How are these images being condensed? How are these sound bites being condensed? What are they focusing on? What does it mean when they focus on the hairstyle of the defendant? What does it mean when, before they talk about the facts of the case, they talk about her composure? Are we creating a narrative that we would like this person to be? Or are we actually trying to understand who this person is and what they've done?
Jeremiah, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeremiah Zager is the director of the HBO documentary Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart.
In May of 2014, a man named Bernie Tiede was released from a Texas prison after 15 years of a life sentence for murder. In 1996, he shot and killed his wealthy patron, a widowed bank owner named Marjorie Nugent. The victim was generally disliked in their hometown of Carthage, Texas, where the cheerful and generous Tiede, by contrast, was universally beloved. Why the neighborly funeral director would murder his sugar mommy intrigued not only the citizens of Carthage, but also film director Richard Linklater, who eventually made a movie about the crime titled Bernie.
If the people in Carthage were to make a list of those people that they thought would get to heaven, I am sure that Bernie would be right at the top of the list.
When Bernie was released in May of last year, we spoke to Skip Hollandsworth, co-author of Linklater's film. It was his story in the Texas Monthly that triggered the director's interest, a story itself inspired by an oddball police blotter item from 18 years ago.
So in August 1997, I'm reading the Dallas Morning News, and there's a two-paragraph brief about this funeral home director arrested for the murder of 81-year-old Marjorie Nugent, the town's grande dame. She was a widow whose husband had been a very wealthy oilman and was the town's banker. And the second paragraph read, T.D. confessed to shooting her four times in the back and burying her in her own deep freeze in the garage, where she remained for 9 months before she was found. And the third paragraph read, T.D. was the sole heir to her estate, but he confessed to police that she was so mean and demanding that he felt he had no choice but to shoot her anyway. And that afternoon, I'm on my way to Carthage in the heart of East Texas.
And when you arrive, it gets weirder, because instead of being reviled, you discover T.D. is seen as the victim himself.
When I get there, I go to the town's restaurant, Daddy Sam's Barbecue, which has a marquee out front that literally reads, "You kill it, I'll cook it." And there sat the district attorney, Danny Buck Davidson, surrounded by townspeople who were saying things like, "Now, Danny Buck, we love Bernie. He made a mistake. Yes, it was a bad mistake, but can't you forgive him? He's good to our town. He's the best man we've got in this town." And at the same time, they're talking about how no one really liked Mrs. Nugent. And I thought, good Lord, this is a movie. And I thought that the first 10 minutes I was there.
Well, you were right about that. It was indeed a movie. I'm curious whether you attribute those sentiments, T.D.'s popularity, to his native friendliness or to the level of disgust the town had for the murder victim, or the fact that he had looted her bank account and stock assets to be a sort of one-man charitable institution.
I think it was a combination of all three. Bernie was the most loved guy in town. He did things like help people with their curtains. He did their taxes. And he did their funerals so beautifully that everyone went to funerals just to see how Bernie would do the funeral of the next person who died in town. That was a kind of kindness that had nothing to do with money. He shook everybody's hand. He visited all the widows in town. And as a journalist, I went to great lengths to try to find some dark streak in his past that would prove, oh, of course, that's why he would commit a murder at some point in his life. But there was nothing. Okay, then at the same time, there was this generic disgust at Mrs. Nugent. She wasn't monstrous, but she could be mean-spirited, angry, snobbish. One woman told me that if Mrs. Nugent held her nose any higher, she'd have drowned in a rainstorm. And then you're right. There was Bernie the Robin Hood, who did things like when the trophy shop was going out of business, he wrote checks off Mrs. Nugent's account to keep it in business because he thought kids deserved trophies when they won soccer tournaments or went to ballet recitals. He wrote a check to help build the Sunday school wing of the Methodist Church. He bought people that couldn't afford it cars or furniture. He paid for college educations at the local junior college.
But he shot Mrs. Nugent with a .22 caliber rifle four times and put her in a freezer for 9 months, and he had to pay his debt to society, life imprisonment in Texas. Now, that's the backstory. Let's hear for a moment how it sounded in Linklater's movie, Bernie T.D., as portrayed by Jack Black.
One time I got four teenagers to rededicate their lives to Jesus, but eventually I realized I was meant for other equally important things.
Oh, please, Bernie, touching all those cold, bloated bodies, please. Don't you think you were meant to do something more?
No, 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 Mrs. Nugent. It isn't bad at all. Their souls are already with the Lord by the time I'm involved. It's just my way to serve and show respect for the lives they led and comfort all the loved ones that they leave behind.
Now, Skip, you know Bernie T.D. Was Jack Black Bernie?
Jack Black went to see Bernie in prison. And in an hour, came out with Bernie's accent, his little voice, his handshake, his mincing walk.
Do not over-cosmetize. Most of those who service the deceased apply far too much blush. Just a note to always remember, too much color does not make one look more alive.
It was a remarkable kind of cinematic experience for Jack because, you know, he got to play a role that the studios never let him play. In this little independent film, he got to sing, dance, act, and commit murder.
So neither your screenplay nor Linklater's film was in any way a political statement. It was not an amicus brief in defense of Bernie Tiede.
Correct. And there was never a conversation that, you know, this movie might help Bernie someday.
Yet it did. How?
It had an effect on a young attorney named Jody Cole, who saw the movie at a premiere in Austin where Richard Linklater, the director, was attending. She walks up to him and says, "There's something about this case that doesn't make sense to me. How such a sweet, gentle, congenial young man could do something so vicious and so inexplicable." She said, "There has to be another story." And she said, "I'd like to take over the case and see if maybe I can find something to appeal, not his guilt, but his punishment."
So what Jody Cole discovers is the hitherto undisclosed fact that Tiede was sexually abused as a child. She argues that if the jury had known this about Bernie in his original trial, they would have given him a lesser sentence. The DA who prosecuted Bernie in the first place agrees as well, and Bernie can leave prison pending a petition for retrial on a few conditions, right?
The judge says, "I will let Bernie out on a personal recognizant bond if y'all show me that he has a full-time job and a place to stay where he can be supervised." The attorney said, "Bernie will work for me." And then Richard Linklater, one of the great directors in America right now, walks into the courtroom and says, "Bernie can live in my garage apartment in Austin." But the fact is that Bernie might not be free for that long because the State Court of Criminal Appeals is going to decide whether there should be another trial for Bernie with this new evidence presented. And a jury in East Texas might listen to the new sexual abuse evidence and go, "Hogwash. You murdered an old lady. You not only shot her, you shot her in the back, which you don't do in East Texas, and off to prison you go for the rest of your life." So that scenario is still possible.
So what is your role in this now? Are you the interested party co-screenwriter? Are you back on the beat as a journalist covering the Tiede case? What's your next move?
My journalist hat is back on, but the very interesting thing is everybody wants an interview with Bernie, but one of the conditions of his being released on personal bond was the judge said he could have no, quote, voluntary contact with the media. So he can't give interviews. So the mystery of Bernie and what he was thinking and what he's like still haunts Texans today.
Skip, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. I enjoyed it.
Skip Hollandsworth wrote about Bernie Tiede back in 1998 for Texas Monthly and has in one way or another been following the story ever since.
Nobody in a million years could have imagined that that could have happened.
Shock! I could not believe Bernie did this.
No way.
Coming up, amateur detectives solve murders committed long ago and far away.
There's one web sleuth in my book who solves a case where the only clue was a decapitated head.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The crime dramas that fill our shelves and our screens seem not just to reflect, but also inspire events in the real world. For instance, this real-life phenomenon could make a seamless transition to TV. Picture this: a thriving community of internet sleuths spending hours in front of their computers trying to attach names to bodies long, sometimes decades dead and still unidentified. Deborah Halber's book about these digital detectives came out this spring. It's called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Last July, the science writer explained how her obsession with these online investigators began suddenly while she was reading her local newspaper.
I came across a photo in the Boston Globe, I think it was 2010, and this woman was just really stunning, sort of auburn hair and these really beautiful eyes and this kind of Mona Lisa smile. And then I realized this wasn't a photograph. It was a reconstruction of a woman who had been brutally murdered in Provincetown, Massachusetts in 1974. And they still didn't know who she was. I ran to my computer and started Googling, and I realized that hers was far from an isolated case, that there were, by one estimate, 40,000 sets of human remains scattered around the country, literally, you know, stowed in the back rooms of morgues, bones in cardboard boxes, people who had been buried in potter's fields. And this struck me as an enormous case of national neglect. So when I started Googling, one of the first things I came across was an organization called the Doe Network, as in Jane and John Doe. Elaborate websites, bulletin boards, databases. People had, over the years, created, it was almost like a gold mine of data that they could mine for information to try to connect missing people with the unidentified.
The things that we think are pretty foolproof, like DNA and fingerprints and dental records, these things are not perfect and even in some cases utterly useless.
Yes, the stories in my book all start out a little bit like something you might see on Bones or CSI or Law and Order with a body being found. But unlike those shows, there is no magic board where you can click some buttons or some great computer program where suddenly the person's license and DNA profile pop up. It does not work like that. And in addition, a forensic anthropologist is looking at clues that can be very, very hard to decipher. Age can be off as many as 10 years. A family might have seen a woman in nothing but heels, and then when they reported her missing, her height is off by 2 or 3 inches. A family may not know that their son or daughter has a tattoo. The FBI does oversee a database called the National Crime Information Center. And this is a repository of everything: stolen cars, stolen bonds, stolen guns. And it became also the repository for law enforcement to use for unidentified bodies or body parts. The problem with it was it wasn't really designed for that. Another problem was that medical examiners had no access to it, and they were the ones holding the body, so to speak. A forensic odontologist who analyzes dental records wondered how much dental records were actually available in the NCIC. So he did a little experiment. He's in the Pacific Northwest, and he knew of remains of several victims of the Green River Killer. He knew their dental records were in NCIC. So he put in the description of the remains, searched, and the system failed to match these women with their dental records, even though it was all in the same system. And he published this in the Journal of Forensic Sciences as an example of how NCIC really was not the right means to do this task.
Is there any official database available to these web sleuths?
A really wonderful step in the right direction is a National Institute of Justice initiative called the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, and it's shortened as NAMIS. This is an attempt to assemble all of this information in one repository that is accessible to the public, to law enforcement, to medical examiners. This is fairly recent. It is online. It is not fully populated with all the information out there, but it is definitely a step in the right direction.
You note that these unidentifieds tend to get buried, if not literally, at least in the priorities of local law enforcement. Explain why that is.
No one owns the Does.
The John and Jane Does.
The John and Jane Does. If the person is clearly a victim of a homicide, law enforcement will certainly be on top of it for a little while. But it's really hard to investigate a murder when you don't even know the victim's name. And once they become a cold case, it becomes increasingly difficult.
So you were caught by a detail, a photograph. The web sleuths that you profile in your fascinating book, many of them were drawn in by some detail, some shred of a story, and then one story leads to another.
It is very true that many of the people have almost adopted a single case. There's just something about one person, and it might be a local that they just find incredibly compelling, and they get kind of sucked in. And then before they know it, they just are engrossed in the work. It's very difficult, detail-oriented, time-consuming, and ultimately can be incredibly frustrating.
Why is it so hard?
Because NamUs is a fairly recent phenomenon, without that kind of central repository, you're just looking all over the place. Public records, ancestry.com, newspaper clips, archives in libraries. It's literally a needle in a haystack.
Could you profile the average web sleuth that you encountered?
They're a very diverse group, yet I feel like there are a few things they have in common. One of them seems to be that they are very, very smart people who like a challenge and like a mystery, but they're underemployed. Their day jobs are not as intellectually challenging as they might be. There's one web sleuth in my book who solves a case where the only clue was a decapitated head. It's a story that starts with a trucker at a truck stop in Missouri who spots what looks like an ordinary plastic bucket, but when they went to move it out of the way, they realized it was filled with cement. And over time, some of the cement started to chip away, and it looked like a human jawbone emerging from the cement, like something from an archaeological dig. And law enforcement didn't have much to go on. They did eventually ask one of the most amazing forensic artists, the late Frank Bender, to do a bust based on the skull. His work is astounding. I've seen recreations he's done based on nothing more than a jawbone, and they are just the most vital, lifelike things you can imagine. So Frank came up with a bust of a middle-aged man who was a little graying, a little jowly. Looked like a really nice guy, like a guy you'd want to pass time of day with while you're online in the post office. But no one seemed to know who this man was. So meanwhile, Ellen Leach is based in Mississippi. She had originally come across the bust, and she just went to work. And this process spanned years and finally came upon a photograph of Gregory May, who was missing from Iowa. Now, during the big gap in time between the head and the bucket was found and Gregory May went missing, and the aftermath, which was that a man was actually on trial for his murder, even though they did not have a body. This would be Iowa's first case of prosecuting a murder case with no body. So they were not very hopeful, but it was almost like one of them called a divine intervention. Suddenly, Ellen's suggestion that this reconstruction matched Gregory May was finally investigated. He was quickly identified, and they were able to get a conviction in the case.
What's your favorite story from the book?
They all strike me as just as fascinating as anything out of a crime thriller or an episode of Bones. So they all have this amazing mystique about them. What really struck me most, though, are the people themselves and their different quirky personalities, their different motives, their different ways of approaching the task. There's a woman named Daphne Owings who has this amazing visual memory. She could scan dozens of images like the one I mentioned of the Lady of the Dunes and then scan missing persons reports. She can just in her mind's eye visualize if there are any that could be potential matches.
And what you're talking about basically are literally hundreds of images of the unidentified remains and hundreds of images of missing persons. So if you don't have that ability, you just can't put those pieces together.
Yes, I call it an enormous game of concentration going on across the entire country.
You started out compelled by a reconstruction that appeared in the Boston Globe. Did you try and find out who it was?
I did, and I discovered that I make a lousy web sleuth. It is just such grueling work. I enlisted the help of one of the people I profile in the book. He also has several solves under his belt. His name is Bobby Lingos. He lives in Quincy, Massachusetts, and he works as a police dispatcher. So he actually has the ability to hook into NCIC as a member of law enforcement. So that's an enormous advantage for him. So I called up Bobby and I was like, you've got to help me. I really want to try to do this. We're going to look for Lady of the Dunes, the reconstruction that I had seen in the Globe of the woman who had been murdered in Provincetown in 1974, the coldest unsolved case in Massachusetts. But after a few hours of poring through missing person reports, it quickly became apparent to me that I didn't have what it took.
So what's your next thing?
You know, I've still got some cases that did not make their way into the book. And I've gotten, if you can't tell, I've gotten a little sucked into this world myself. And there's...
You can't solve the cases, but you're the bard of these cases?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. And
so at this point, you're not going to try and solve anymore. It's just too hard, but it's just too good to let go. So you're not walking away yet.
Right.
Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Deborah Halber is a Boston-based science writer. Her book is called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases.
For some writers, crime is not viewed as a tantalizing mystery, a chance to probe humanity's dark corners. It's just death, tragic and senseless, that the writer must convey quickly in a few deft strokes. Over 4th of July weekend in Chicago last year, there were 82 shootings in which 16 people died. Peter Nikias, the Chicago Tribune's overnight crime reporter, was on the scene at many of them. The nature of his job is chronic violence. The soundtrack of his nights is the police scanner.
So in the summer, I'll grab a car, two scanners, a laptop, camera. We'll head out to 31st and Halsted. It's safe. It's near highways. There's a 24-hour CVS and Dunkin' Donuts. The bathrooms are clean. Coffee's always hot. These are basic things that are important if you're going to spend 10 hours out, right? Now, if something pops, if there's a shooting, we'll go to the shooting. You can count on a certain number of them during a shift. So the police department will give out a script and they'll say, you know, male 25 found unresponsive at this location. The offender approached on foot, fired shots, and fled in a car. There's probably a lot more to that that you're not going to get unless you go to the scene. And it may not mean talking to witnesses, because witnesses aren't often forthcoming. Police get to them often before we do, but, you know, you talk to family, to neighbors and residents, piece together what the person's life may have been like, what the conflict that led to this may be doing to the neighborhood. There's just a lot of ways of looking at violence other than just what has been traditionally box score type coverage.
When you are listening to the scanner, do you find yourself zigzagging around the city, not sure about which scene to drive to?
We have nights where it feels like we're chasing ghosts. There'll be a night where three quarters of the victims are walk-in gunshot victims and they leave no crime scene behind, or they give a bad location for where they were shot because they don't want police to find out where they were.
The cliche is, it was like a war zone. But amid the bullets zinging all around you, it must really seem that way.
I've never been to war, so I don't want to say that. I've been to more than 400 crime scenes over the past couple of years, and this weekend was the absolute first time where I felt like I wasn't in Chicago. It didn't feel real. It was weightless. There's a helicopter, not just like buzzing on the periphery, but like the thump, thump, thump right over you. Guys running around in coveralls with rifles, people screaming in the radio that they're still shooting. And then while there's 150 cops or whatever around, somebody shot up a house a couple blocks south. So all the cops go running south. That huge presence, an escalation of force basically from like basic patrol to something more like infantry tactics. There was 30 people shot in 13 hours.
On nights like you spent last weekend, are you looking for the particulars of a given story? Because after all, these are all individual stories with individual people and individual motives and consequences.
On a good night, we'll get to the why, not just the police department stated version of why, the actual why, you know, which you get from being at a scene, talking to neighbors, relatives, talking to police who can give you more context about things, and then trying to read the neighborhood a little bit, look for gang graffiti, have neighbors point things out to you. When there's that many shootings, we can't get to the why.
You tend to get impatient when the police and the administration try constantly to put a given spasm of violence in the context of a lower overall homicide rate. Another thing they do is, putting aside urban decay, is talk about moral decay and suggest that you can only put so many cops on the street, But in the end, it comes down to values.
As far as the crime is down thing, people get annoyed with that specifically because they don't think it's necessarily an appropriate response to a tragedy. Usually the crime is down statement follows either a bad weekend or an incident where, you know, somebody that's just not involved in the drug trade, not involved in gangs, gets killed. As far as the whole values thing, it doesn't strike me as something somebody would say if they've been out there, because I can tell you personally, like, witnessing these things, it has an effect on you. If you're a kid in Inglewood, for example, this is a 20 block by 22 block neighborhood that on a normal year could see 30 to 40 homicides. What does that amount of trauma do to your development growing up in that, where gunfire is normal, where hearing people screaming is normal, where you're getting woken up by sirens in the middle of the night? Yeah, I get it. Like, it's ultimately an individual's decision to pull a trigger, but there's more at play there. I don't think it's a very nuanced thing to say.
You mentioned the effect that this has on children growing up in this environment. What kind of effect does it have on you? Tell me about your soul. Have you any left?
I think I have probably less faith in people in general than I used to. You know, you see so many bad things, you're like, okay, you know, people basically will disappoint given the opportunity. But then, like, we'll get to a neighborhood, and I was talking to a woman. She's like, yeah, my family was the second black family on the block, and we were so proud. Like, when my parents bought the home, they were doing the American dream thing, right? She didn't want to move because this is her house. So to see people, like, taking a stand and saying, no, I'm not going to let the little gangbangers run me off, that kind of restores your faith a little bit. This job has made me hypersensitive, I think, to other people's emotions. You try to throw up the shield as a defense mechanism, you're not going to be a good reporter. The stories I'm most proud of, we're showing moms using a dead kid down the street as a lesson to their kids. Or you see people praying over their dead loved ones. And I think if you just say, nope, I got to steel myself to this, I'm not going to let it affect me, you're not going to be able to get any of that. So I feel like I'm more able to connect with people than I was before the job, which is a good thing. Now, I have a hard time sleeping, and I don't know if it's because I work overnights and I got to sleep when it's sunny out, or if it's because of the, like, I hear scanners when I go to sleep. And then not sleeping aggravates everything else. So, like, I have a shorter fuse than I used to. And I can keep it in check. Like, I can feel my blood boiling. I don't punch walls, but I can feel myself getting enraged a lot quicker than I used to.
There's one episode that you reported on that was just heartbreaking. A father whose son lay dead. He was praying for a miracle. Can you tell me?
His whole thing was he just wanted to pray over his son. When he approached the supervisor and the detectives and said, I want to do this, they said, well, we got to finish our investigation up and then we'll let you do it. And so he stuck around just like he said he would. When it was clear they were wrapping up, the sergeant walked over to him and he's like, you know, how you picture your son right now is not how he looks. And if you go see him, you know, that's how you're going to remember him. He's just trying to talk him out of it gently. And he's like, no, man, I need to pray for my son. So they walked him over. They didn't rush him. He stood there, he prayed, he walked away, and that was it. They called a fire engine to come hose the blood off the scene, and they hauled him away. I was debating over whether to write this. What I figured was this was something that anybody who's standing out here, anybody watching from anywhere would have seen. The man was comfortable talking to me. He gave me his name, his phone number. I felt like just observing and writing what I saw, stating it as plainly as possible without using flowery language, just say what happened, that it would provide a light into these situations for the public who may not see what it's like unless you have somebody there watching and explaining what it's like for a grieving parent at a crime scene.
Pete, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Nikias is the overnight crime reporter for the Chicago Tribune. We spoke to him immediately after the 4th of July weekend. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. But the heavy lifting for this show was done by former OTM producer Laura Mayer. We had more help from Maya Brownstein, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippin.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.